Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman.
John Carter from tcgen.com. Welcome to the Exagility podcast. How are you doing today?
Very good, John. Thank you.
John, you're probably most famous for being the chief engineer for the noise cancelling headphones at Bose. I'm actually wearing these headphones right now. I've got two sets of them here. And I'd love to hear how you even got to that point of being chief engineer on that innovation.
It starts actually with graduate school. And I was doing graduate studies at MIT, and I was taking a course in acoustics from Dr. Bose. And that was one of the reasons I chose that school, is they have a great acoustics program. And I was a student in the class, upper division class. And the first day of class, Dr. Bose said, "We've had a problem and our teaching assistant is not able to join us. So is there anyone in the class who thinks they'd be able to be a teaching assistant and lead the course?"
Wow.
At least co-teach it with me. And I raised my hand, and I was definitely interested in talking to him. I'd never had the subject before. And he went back to his office. He interviewed me in 20 minutes. He decided to take me on. And what was really a part of innovation is being lucky. He grilled me on my specialty as an undergraduate. It had nothing to do with the acoustics. It had to do with something called linear systems, but basically the building block of how things work. And it just so happened that I had studied that subject. And he said, "If you understand that, then you can teach acoustics or help me teach it." And I did that. And John, it was the biggest lesson of my life, because I learned humility, because there were some smart kids. I know this sounds outrageous. I got one homework paper turned into me. It took me 6 pages to solve the problem. A kid did it. He's a freshman. He did it in one page, and I couldn't understand it. So I took it to my roommate, who was a math major, and he said, "This is correct." So you learn to be humble in situations like that. But somehow I broke through it. And after I taught the course, I then did research at Bose, working on a magnetic simulation program, studied hard and really enjoyed the firm. Went back and finished up my grad studies, and then I was hired right on the spot to join him. And one of the things that Dr. Bose does that I think is unusual and shows how much he devotes to teaching in general, with the largest word, largest definition, is he takes on recent grad students as his research assistant. So even though he has a corporation of 1,000 people and they've got 100 in R&D or 200 in R&D, he sets aside time to work with one or two of his grad students to work on an innovation. And he carves out the time to do it. So I'm not meeting with my manager's manager. I'm just meeting directly with Dr. Bose. And we're working on a couple of difficult problems together that I started right after graduation. And he was amazing in that way. He really invested in people.
Was he like a mentor, John, or a coach?
Very much. Principled man, very quick study, very smart, and had very selective interests. He did not like operations. He did not like finance. He spent no time on that. The only two things he did was marketing and engineering. That was it. He was passionate, but he would invest so much time in me. I'd spend 4 or 5 hours in his office, and we'd be working on a giant blackboard in his office, scribbling equations and talking about things. And he was a terrific coach.
Is there a lot of mathematics in sound then, John, in sound engineering?
A lot. It's more so, even electrical engineering or circuits or mechanical engineering is complicated, but acoustics is what's called, it's in the wave domain. So it deals with space and time as opposed to just time. And so you have to actually model space as a parameter, and that leads you to advanced math, which I enjoyed, but it's challenging for sure.
It kind of reminds me when I go to music concerts that you've got these sound engineers working in the middle of the park. There must be some delay, I'm guessing, in the sound going to the speakers and trying to avoid an echo through the stadium, things like that.
Yeah, it's true. And John, one of my first projects, rather my master's thesis, was on how can you actually make a spatially continuous microphone? So let's say you had a violinist playing. How would you wrap a microphone, if you could do it like saran wrap, all the way around the musician and capture the sound from every angle? What would that sound like? And so that was one of my first challenges, and I basically proved it wouldn't sound good.
Yeah.
It took a year and a half.
interesting. I saw a guy at an airport the other day and he had a 360 camera and he was showing it to other people. I'm not sure, was it a prototype, because I couldn't find it on Google. And literally it could see the whole table. And one of the people at the table was saying, oh, this is amazing, this is amazing, this is amazing. But I kept thinking about it. I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure how that would work. Yeah,
exactly.
What was the culture like at Bose, John? So you mentioned you were with Dr. Bose and he was carving out time and you were blackboard and you're working things out. He was coaching, he was mentoring, and there was a lot of learning there. But if he wasn't interested in the operations and the finance side, and he was more interested in the marketing and the engineering side, how did the rest of Bose work then? Did he like appoint CEOs, or how did that work in Bose?
Oh, yes. He had essentially a president, and the president focused on operations, manufacturing, finance, HR, the running of the company.
Yeah.
And typically, and this is fascinating, he had good success at picking out presidents, people who are operators and could work very well. And he also had good success in picking out engineers and engineering leaders and manufacturing and so forth. But what he could never find, we could never find, is someone good in marketing. Product management, when you try and bring new to the world products to the marketplace, is really hard. How do you convince people to spend a pretty penny on something that didn't exist before? Why do they need it? And how do you compare it? How do you rate it? How do you review it? How do you put it on a table compared to other things if there's nothing to compare to? So we had a real challenge with finding marketing people. But I must say, the culture there was very egalitarian. It was merit-based. If you did a good job, you were rewarded and promoted and got to do the things that you wanted to do. And specifically on culture, Dr. Bose hated politics. And he defined it as anything not in the interest of the company. And boy, he was fierce about it. So one of the things that he did weed out and was marvelous for the culture is politics. And as I become an executive and leader in other organizations, it's much more common to find politics than an egalitarian, merit-based workplace. It was just an amazing part of the culture and a real tribute to the man who wouldn't stand for it.
I'm trying to imagine, while you were working on this initiative for basically inventing, I'm not sure if you even knew you were going to be inventing, that already came up, how it happened. I'm curious to hear that story. I'm just trying to imagine what the scene would look like. Were there information radiators on the wall? What was the buzz like? I'm guessing there was a room where you worked together. I don't know. Can you give us some kind of an audio picture, John? Because people would be listening to this as opposed to seeing us maybe on YouTube. But what would they have seen if they walked in and saw you and Dr. Bose and others in the lab working on this? What was it like?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. In Dr. Bose's office, it was covered in glass. So it was a corner office, and he had views of the Massachusetts countryside, beautiful views. It was on a hill. The rest of the room was covered with glass you could write on. So he probably had 40 feet of white space to write equations and brainstorm and collaborate. It was an amazing environment. And he used to take notes on copier paper. You just go through page after page. And so the brainstorming culture there was just fantastic. Everything was very much out in the open. At the same time, it was very secretive because we thought these ideas could be valuable. Used by other, were valuable. And so we shared amongst each other in the corporation quite a bit, but really were very tight-lit outside the corporation. We worked in something called the Turkey Farm. There was a true turkey farm not far from our headquarters. And this is where all the new scraggly engineers were. So I had a cubicle and I did most of my work in the lab. You need a special room called an anechoic chamber, echo-free room. And that's where we did all of the testing. So most of the time I would be in that room or with test equipment just outside it. And then the remainder split between Dr. Bose's office and my office. So really just those three places. The team was very small. It was myself, a technician, and Dr. Bose. That was it. Very small, nimble team. And that was really important because we could move quickly, fail fast.
How did you trip onto this? Was it like by accident? Was it by design? How would you describe it looking back now?
John, it comes back to the story I told about this concept of linear systems. Dr. Bose is very much a thinker about systems in the most abstract ways. And this started out as a cocktail sketch, really started out as an idea that he had hatched on a flight on a napkin, just a simple sketch of what would happen if you put a microphone right near the speaker and you could somehow manage the feedback so the feedback didn't take place. What could that do? And so what's really interesting is we started on the wrong path. So we started, we wired the circuit up, and our goal was to improve the fidelity, make it sound better. But it turned out that as we tested it and exposed it to customers, they really felt that it was the noise canceling that was really the benefit. Of course, it had great sound, but what was truly remarkable was that it reduced outsized noise. And this was not a necessarily design goal. When Dr. Bose came up with the original sketch, it was more like a thought experiment. What if we did this? Then we could make better sounding speakers and headphones. And only after exposing it to true users and customers and trying it ourselves, we realized, boy, the biggest benefit's not there. It's in sound reduction. And of course, now that's what it's called, the noise canceling headphone. But we didn't start out to make a noise canceling headphone. That was not the goal.
And often you can come across a wonderful product, but it can be like the world's biggest secret. So I like what you're saying there, that marketing was important. What would you say would be, like, from a marketing point of view, I'm not sure how much you are into marketing, but what, looking back, what would you say would be, if someone's inventing a product and you really want it to go well, apart from having a brand, because Bose would already probably have had a brand at that point, what would be a key pattern for you to make sure the world knows that this invention actually exists?
Yeah. So I do practice a lot in marketing and product management specifically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a couple things that I think are secrets here, or at least best practices that I think other executives can leverage and use in their own product sphere, is that one of the key things that Bose did was we invested heavily in third-party credibility. So rather than doing advertising to toot our own horn, what we would do is we would develop long-term relationships with product reviewers in Japan, in the United States, and in Europe, and get them to review our products and give us feedback on the products and take their guidance and their input basically to address their needs. And boy, when you do that, they will talk about what you've done, and third-party credibility is absolutely absolutely key. There's another thing that he used to say, which is that better implies different, not the other way around. In other words, just making something different for the sake of doing so, if it has no benefit, then what are you doing? You're doing a random sort of marketing game, just making something a little different color or finish. But truly, if you want to innovate, you're going to have to do it a new way. And so we had a couple of guidelines or mantras, and that was one, and another is great sound from small packages. So we had these very high level principles about how better implies different and great sound from small packages, just no big slogans, vision, mission, all the pyramids and all that stuff, but just a couple of operating principles that were so useful. And then when we coupled that with third-party credibility, we really got great results by doing that. There's another story, though, and this is as profound, very different, and that is in the Wave radio. That was another one of our innovations that we worked on when I was there. And we had no idea how to get that to market. So Dr. Bose actually bought and operated an audio store in Hawaii and used it as a retail laboratory to figure out how to sell things. And so we invented this Wave radio. It had marvelous sound, but it cost so much more than a $20 clock radio. Sounded vastly better, but it cost so much more. How would you ever demonstrate that if you went into a big box retailer or bought it online? You couldn't hear the benefits. So that took Dr. Bose on an odyssey to actually invent distribution with the product. So we tried door-to-door sales. We tried lots of email marketing inserts in the Wall Street Journal. And then we stumbled on Paul Harvey, which was a very popular AM radio announcer in the United States, and used this third-party credibility. And the product just took off word of mouth that way. And we realized we could never make it with just retail distribution because the product would never be demonstrated. It just be put on a shelf with a bunch of other clock radios. You had to actually experience it. But if you had someone who you trusted said, this really sounds great, you should check it out, that made a world of difference. So this third-party credibility, along with really being inventive about distribution and not being fixed to your existing distribution, were a couple of real success stories that we used.
That's a very strong signal for the culture as well, because it demonstrates talking to the customers, listening to what they're looking for, maybe doing some deep listening as well, for maybe they're actually not looking at that, they're looking at something else, and you didn't expect them to look at that thing, and you're maybe curious about why they're looking at that thing. Yeah.
Yes, it's often called solution-free discovery. In other words, you're not trying to say, here, try this, it's the latest and greatest, but actually look, what are you trying to do?
Yeah, exactly. Indy Young, I interviewed her a few episodes back, and she was talking about that a lot, that there's a tendency for people to interview customers with a script, and there's value in that, in discovery at a particular point, once you understand what the problem is. But if you don't understand the problem you're trying to solve, sometimes you need to go zip and just listen and let the customer keep talking and just see where it goes.
Yes. Yes. And I think even in B2B sales, which a lot of us do, just spending time listening and not talking about all the great features and benefits, but rather what problem are you trying to solve? And then not place the solution on it allows you to really leapfrog others who actually talk too much.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's interesting. I've got a sound filter on my computer here, and it tells me what percentage of calls I was talking. And I see it as a kind of a metric for how much am I listening?
Oh, that's punishing. You really have that.
It's kind of okay. It's just a new thing that came up recently. If I have a one-to-one, for example, and if it says I'm talking 40%, I'm okay with that. But maybe sometimes it should be maybe 10%. Yeah.
Interesting.
It depends. Yeah. John, what happened to you then after that innovation? We're going to come back later on talking about portfolio investments and how you pick which thing to back and so on. But what happened to you after that innovation at Bose? Where did you go after there?
Actually, to fill out the story, I was just an individual contributor when I came up with that invention with Dr. Bose and put it into practice. And then from there, I went to a manager of the acoustics group. And then I was promoted to be chief engineer and oversaw the company's R&D efforts for many years while we grew. And at some point, I decided that I wanted to do my own thing. And so I decided to leave, not knowing what I was going to be doing. But I wanted to start something, and I was young enough so I could take the risks and afford to fail.
Yeah.
And so I looked at a couple of different things, and I really weighed, I could either do acoustical consulting work, or I love this management stuff, maybe I could do this. And I just decided to place a bet on the management side and share with people the best practices and how to bring products to market quickly. So that's been my passion ever since that moment. It was my passion at Bose. I just love bringing together people and problems, solving them and creating value and making the world a better place. I love that.
That sounds really nice. So you mentioned product management, you mentioned marketing. What else do you bring to bear when you're doing that, John, when you're trying to help your clients? I guess you're working with clients, right?
Yeah, half my career has been an executive. Half of it has been working as an advisor. I'm not like a hammer that I think every problem is a nail. I think very much like your practice is you actually listen and find out what your clients need in terms of what are they trying to accomplish, what are they trying to do. And I tend to look at organizations and people and structures probably the number one area. What I find so typically is overload. And this is where Agile, I think, comes in really handy, because good Agile systems really have teams that are focused. And what I find in, with a lot of companies are that they've become just tyrannized by thousands of little projects and are being cut by paper. And so really focus and accountability has been one thing that I've really found. It's painful because you have to determine what you don't do. But often having someone from the outside say, you've got to stop X, Y, and Z is authoritative and will help people get over the hump. But part of what I do is also in the innovation space as well. So it's balanced between execution and innovation. And I've certainly, one of the things that I think is really unique is how well and pervasive you can apply Agile principles to all kinds of practices. As I work primarily in R&D and engineering and product development, and people say they make hardware like cars or coffee pots, we can't be Agile here. And that's not true. The only thing you can't do is a two-week sprint to do tooling and get a new custom part. But there's so many other things that you can do. Don't let that be a barricade for you. So often I just help I provide a pathway for agility by thinking about it more broadly.
That sounds really nice. A lot of people are looking for a pathway to agility. And so what I picked up in my language, when you talked about overload and focus, that for me like would be like flow at a strategy level, figuring out what's our capacity in terms of how many things can we really do at the same time. And I see so many executives kind of making the mistake of thinking it's all about being happy, clappy, collaborating, and we all work in loads of things, but we could all end up just suffering because we haven't decided to really focus on what's important. And particularly companies that are doing really well, actually, there's some famous stories about Nokia and other companies that were, they were doing really well, had their best years ever. They're the ones that I worry about the most, and they really struggle to focus.
Yes, yes. I think also to innovate, you need focus. Yes. You need to pick a spot and you actually need to staff it because there are going to be many failures, many dead ends, and you need people that are absolutely on spot with the target and are undeterred from it because they will be buffeted by so many forces. So this notion of really having a central focus or a purpose, it's risky because you're not, I think, and this is why executives don't do this. They want to spread their bets out, but yeah, you can't be successful if you're constantly hedging.
Exactly. And you're just spinning plates everywhere and everyone's really busy. And then people don't get time to think, actually. And the stuff that you did in the past, and I'm sure you're still doing in terms of innovation, it becomes a kind of a victim to the whole situation, doesn't it? We're not finding the next big thing, if you like.
Yeah. And I think one of the challenges, John, that people have is that when they innovate, they try and make everything different. We're going to go after new markets, new technology, new distribution, new this, new that. And the much more sensible way to innovate, my experience, is innovate on one dimension, provide something transformational, either in distribution or in product or in market or in manufacturing or in customer service and support. Don't try and change all the variables at once. Your corporation, your focus, you've got a lot of strengths. Leverage those and don't stop innovating, but don't do it on multiple dimensions at the same time. In other words, focus your innovation on what I call adjacencies. Just change one variable. Change it dramatically, but just change one variable.
That's a really good tip. I was talking to a gentleman called Dave Snowden a few months ago on this podcast, and he was talking about when he was an executive, he had people coming into him all the time saying, this is the best idea ever. And someone else would say, this is the best idea ever. And so what he did was he just got each of them to just start something and just see whether there was any traction. They weren't spending big money. It was like a small little seed fund to just see what happens, because his philosophy was you don't really know which thing is going to win. Actually, one of the problems I have with the whole MVP, minimal viable product idea, and product management is it's almost like James Bond going into a big casino in Las Vegas, put all his money in the first four tables, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
And all the actions on table number nine. So it does ring a bell with me what Dave was saying, but at the same time, how do you decide, like with a portfolio of investments, like how do you pick your priorities, what you go with, and what's your experience been with that, John?
I think you've got what your corporate objectives are, what you think are valuable. What you want to do is a first sense test that I would look at in terms of portfolios. Does this leverage your brand? Does this leverage what you do and you do well? And then once you understand there's good alignment, then you look at, will it move the needle? In other words, will it give you a good return, either internal rate of return or net present value? In other words, is it material? And then the final question you ask is, can I win? Is it worth it? And can I win? Win worth. First is alignment. Leverage, therefore, with your business. And then the second is, you know, is there a there? And then third, competitively, can I provide a differentiated offering? And that's one of the things that I think is one of the important lessons I learned at Bose is the importance of differentiation. Because if you have differentiation, you can charge for it and earn margin, which will fund R&D. So it's a virtuous circle. R&D creates differentiation. Differentiation allows you to charge for it. You charge for it, that funds R&D, and it's a really great virtuous cycle. So those are some of the principles I use, but really invest in differentiation isn't important. Not a me too. Like just slapping your logo on it. No, that's not going to do it. Why does this product need to be there? How does it earn its place? And that's through differentiation, because it solves a problem better than other solutions, whatever that dimension might be.
Some people would say with the innovations, you persevere or you pivot or you stop. That's what a lot of the discovery people would say, the lean UX people, lean startup people and so on. It seems to be some kind of merit in that, but it should be based on evidence. Have we built up some evidence that we should persevere? Or actually, we've learned actually when we had that retail lab, for example, that we found out that customers wanted something completely different. So we should pivot that way. Or actually, this is the worst thing ever. We should just stop this. What's your experience been with that, John? How do you know which ones to... Okay, they're very good questions to ask, but like, how much rope do you give them, if you like, before you maybe pull the plug on what they're doing?
You hit the nail on the head with that, John. It's what I call zombies. It's projects that you fund and they're really making no progress. But because of sunk costs, you believe we have invested in it, we're just going to keep investing in it. And you can't kill it. But you need to stop it. You need to do something different. And so the biggest problems that I've had is stopping the funding, because companies get, I guess, wooed into some kind of complacency because they've invested so much or their expertise is there. But if you can't provide, as you said, the evidence for progress, you should look at it critically and be willing to cut your losses and admit you were failed and move on.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good tip. But there's a body of knowledge that I'm fond of that Clayton Christensen made famous. It was called Customer Jobs to be Done. And he gave examples in his books about Uber, for example, and Airbnb being examples of jobs that needed to be done that weren't really being served well by other companies before. But say, for example, I'm just making this up, but Halo, like a hail riding app in the UK, when someone came along to them and said, I've got an idea. I want every person in the country to be able to drive a taxi. They have to get a license to go through some checks. And I want to be able to go to the airport within 3 minutes. I don't want to be worried that the taxi driver is going to turn up tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. and then have to ring for 40 minutes trying to find the next one. And so that was a job that needed to be done. But I'm just guessing that when someone went to the product department of that company, they said, no, that doesn't fit with our agenda. That's not what we do. We just serve black cab drivers in London, if that makes sense. Have you seen that kind of stuff going on as well, John, companies you worked with? Because sometimes I feel that some people say you need to go from projects to products, but even product groups can have their own agendas as well. Okay, they're worried about the long-term value of the life cycle, but have you seen limited thinking in that area? Do you have any suggestions for people and maybe how to avoid that?
Yeah, unfortunately, all the time and everywhere, I see that. Yeah. And I really respect Clayton Christensen so much. And one of the terms used for this is innovator's dilemma. The fact that the black taxi cab companies drive black cabs and have drivers of a certain profile that have the knowledge or whatever it requires to have a cab in London, they're constrained by their business model and their mindset, and they can't change. So it really does take an outsider. Even though the black cab company would have so many marketplace advantages, they can't shed their past. And I've worked with medical device companies that have had this problem, consumer electronic companies, office business equipment companies. They just can't shed their past. And that's why I think that you actually do have this innovator's dilemma, and the great innovations come from outside the industry. And there, what I think you need to do, the best countermeasure is to have a very vigorous corporate development function that looks at acquisitions and has the ability to nurture standalone acquisitions and allow them to flourish, even though it may cannibalize your own business. You need to do it, because if you don't do it, others will.
Yeah, I've seen that as a coping strategy by a lot of companies where they acquire companies that are innovating. And then what can happen is they can actually slow them down if you're not careful. So an idea that I've been playing around with is almost creating a new company. So I'm calling it like an island of agility, or maybe even an archipelago of agility, where you get people with the right frame of mind, if you like. You almost have a kind of a nightclub bouncer at the door saying in terms of who's coming in kind of thing. People would be invited. So they wouldn't be voluntold to go in there. But essentially a place where they could have that lovely environment that you had when you were at Bose and probably in other companies as well, where you had the time to think, you could innovate. You still were measured on some things, but you were in a different culture. You were measured by different things. You didn't have maybe some of the behaviors in the mothership, so to speak, or the mainland, mixing my metaphors here, that might compromise that. And so this is an idea I'm exploring, but it's a really brave thing for a company to decide to do, that maybe they need to set up almost like setting up a new company. Have you ever seen that happen?
So frequently. And one of my favorite lines is, we're going to acquire this company, but don't break the toy. In other words, this company was so good for these following attributes. Don't go in and use our culture to fix them because they ain't broke.
Exactly. So don't keep them away or have a bridge or something or get some planes or something.
Don't break the toy. Yes.
So, John, if you had any tips for people in the kind of work that you do, what would be the kind of key pieces of advice that you might offer people where they are trying to figure out what investments to take into their portfolio, or they're trying to figure out how to deal with the current innovations that are going through the pipeline that may be struggling? Have you any tips for people from your experience?
I do. One is patient investing. It really requires investment to make innovation happen. And the second is the thing that we talked about, which is adjacency. So think about the big ideas, but think about them adjacent to what you do well. So you invest and you work on adjacent ideas. I think that's the best way to really deliver compounded growth, not incremental improvement, not freeform, whole-scale, clean sheet kind of innovation, but rather focused, deliberate innovation in one vector, one adjacent sector at a time. And I think if you invest maybe 20% of your total expenditures in that kind of portfolio bet, you'll be in the best position to win in the long term.
One final question for you. Someone asked me a question the other day, like, let's say you did have this startup or this company you acquired, or you set up some island within your organization, you almost created a new organization. Does everybody in there need to be agile, in your opinion, John? What's your feeling about that?
You mean everybody in the host company or the company we've acquired?
The company we've acquired, or even the new company that maybe we might even be setting up. What's your view like? Because I think you hinted at it earlier that you need people to run the place. You still need operations and finance and HR and all that kind of good stuff. And then you got the kind of the creative stuff that's going on. So it's almost like a mixture of energies really that are needed, even in a company that is, you know, doing the next big thing. So what's your experience been in terms of what kind of agility you're looking for from the people that would be in that footprint?
Yeah, I don't know that I would specify it. I would say you bought it for a reason.
Yeah.
Don't break the toy. So if the toy is incredibly agile, learn from it. Don't change it. If it's very waterfall or traditional, but it's working, don't change it. Understand it. So I think very pragmatic look at how they operate and leaving them alone is the best thing to do rather than impose a style.
John Carter, thank you very much for joining us on the Exagility Podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure listening to you. And I had some light bulb moments myself, and I hope the listeners did as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I did too, John. Thank you.